Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Lahav Barkov, diplomatic correspondent and senior contributing editor. And with me, as always, is Yaakov Katz, our editor-in-chief. We are talking on the week of Purim, which is, in my opinion, the most fun Jewish holiday. Everyone gets to dress up in costumes and exchange gift baskets, mishlachim manot. I am extremely busy with news this week, but trying to keep my family in the spirit of the holiday that's coming up. What plans do you have, Yaakov?
Can I just offer a different take on Purim? Not the funnest holiday, in my view.
Really?
Yeah, I was never too into it. All the drinking, all the dressing up. I mean, I think the kids have a great time. Was never my thing. Maybe going to Jewish day schools and yeshivas and seeing too many people hurling their entire contents of their stomach after drinking too much turned me off over the years. But of course, any time that you can have a party is always a good opportunity. And, you know, the to watch my kids have a lot of fun. You know, in schools here, Lahav, your kids are not yet, yeah, I think, of school age, right? They're still in kindergartens and in preschools. But when you have kids in school, it's like a week of celebrations, right? They start last week. There's Yom Pijamot, right? The pajama, yeah, day.
No, my daughter had that too. I call it homework for parents because we had to come up with some new get up.
Right. And let's say you're a bad parent, like maybe I am, and you don't have onesies for your 11-year-old anymore, right? Because they could just go to sleep in a pair of sweatpants and a t-shirt. So what do you do for pajama day, right? That becomes a big headache. And then you have dress up day, and then you have Mishloach Manot day when every kid has to come and bring Mishloach Manot. And then they have another day where they brought breakfast for each other and they like do a lottery who gives breakfast to whom. It's a lot of work, all this, you know?
Yeah, that is true. Well, so I always put a lot into Purim. I always have a themed family costume and Mishloach Manot.
So what's this year?
Yeah, so, and I usually keep a surprise, but this is going to come out after so I can say it, is that this year it's Alice in Wonderland. So my daughter's Alice in Wonderland and my little son's the White Rabbit and I'm going to be the Queen of Hearts and my husband's going to be the Mad Hatter. The problem is that we are a day before Purim and I have not had time to put together a lot of this. So we'll see what happens.
Got to be creative. There's all those party stores that you can go to buy stuff.
Exactly.
But, you know, in addition to all the work that you have to do with Purim, and Alice in Wonderland is definitely ambitious, I at least don't have any ambition in dressing up too much. But there's also a lot of news, right? And you've been writing pretty much daily about the Naftali Bennett pursuit of a ceasefire between Vladimir Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, and Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia. Constant conversations between Bennett and Zelensky, Bennett and Putin, back and forth every single day. It seems like there's something going on. What are the chances that you think this actually succeeds? I know we kind of spoke about this in the past, but it seems like Bennett's unrelenting here.
Yeah, I don't know if unrelenting is the word. I mean, he's definitely persistent, but at the same time, my understanding is he's not trying to push things too much. I mean, and anyway, could you imagine, could anybody really push Vladimir Putin? Like the man is, like, try to understand that man, you know? And so there's like a little bit of a mixed messages, I would say, that I'm getting from the people surrounding Bennett. There's a little bit of cautious optimism because Russia has backed down from its demand for a totally demilitarized Ukraine. And Zelensky has walked back a little bit from wanting to join NATO. He's saying he's cooling off on it, which is something Zelensky said publicly. But at the same time, they don't want to, Israel doesn't want to engage too much in talks when the parties themselves don't want to engage in them. What one source in Bennett's office said to me is, you know, Israel has learned the lesson of its own peace talks with the Palestinians that, you know, when they're not taken seriously, and so they don't end up in some kind of agreement, the violence that comes after could get a lot worse. And I think, you know, the Second Intifada is a big example of that, although we know that Arafat had been planning that for a long time.
By the way, interesting coming from Bennett's office, considering that Bennett is the one who's actually opposed to any long-term diplomatic negotiations with the Palestinians. But okay, we'll put that aside.
A lot of it is ironic in that way. Like Bennett, the peacemaker, and I'm not saying that Bennett is starting wars per se, but you know, he's basically the maximum he would be willing to give the Palestinians doesn't reach the minimum that the Palestinians would be able to accept by, you know, a long mile. But it's not the same conflict. In any case, so there's like cautious optimism, but there's also just caution in general in Jerusalem, that Bennett is willing to facilitate as much as he can, but he also knows that he can't, you know, you can bring a horse to water, you can't force it to drink, that kind of thing.
Good use of a metaphor. Getting back though to the Palestinians for a moment, and of course I know it's, you know, without any doubt in my mind, it is not the same conflict. But sadly, we're continuing to see people who are trying to make it the same conflict, right? There was, I saw about a Geneva Initiative event. This was an organization that was set up because Geneva was a place where a lot of track two talks were held between Israel and Palestinians, Israelis and Palestinians, to learn the lessons of the conflict from Ukraine, between Ukraine and Russia, and apply them to the conflict that Israel has with the Palestinians. Now, I don't know if they're looking at this from a military perspective. I don't know if they're looking at this from a refugee perspective. But this whole attempt by people around the world to draw this comparison is really aimed at something that I think Israelis and people who they care deeply about Israel need to be made aware about. And this is a part of an attempt to delegitimize and undermine the state of Israel. Right? What people will do is that the next conflict that will come, and unfortunately, knowing the past, there likely will be one day between Israel and Hamas and Gaza, they will try to call for the same sanctions that were imposed against Russia on Israel. And they will try to get to rally the world against Israel like the world has rallied against Russia. Israel needs to be aware of this situation and start to, you know, fight back in some way.
Yeah. I see it. The sort of using Israel, using this conflict to try to delegitimize Israel in all kinds of ways. There's that. And then there's all these people who are like, why is Israel silent? Why is Israel neutral? Now, you and I have criticized the government and we think that the government needs to do more. But I don't think that silent or neutral really characterize it. And I kind of feel like if you're going to comment on Israel, like maybe you should read a little more and be a little more thorough because, you know, again, Israel might not be doing what we think it should do, but it's definitely not silent or neutral. And just in the last few days, Foreign Minister Lapid has talked about how, you know, Israel's not going to let people under sanctions on Russia circumvent those sanctions by going through Israel. And that includes citizens of Israel, like the Russian oligarch Roman Abramovich, who, as I reported, has not been allowed to keep his private jet in Israel. Israel doesn't have a law to confiscate the jet.
Are you allowed to keep your private jet in Israel?
I hope one day to be in a position to find out, but I'm not sure that journalism is the way to do it.
No, probably as someone who's been in it a little longer than you have, probably not. This is not the path to private jets. You're 100% right. Israel has been, you know, I think maybe we're a little slow in getting to this point, but Israel has been very vocal in recent days of its criticism and condemnations of Russia, particularly coming from Foreign Minister Yair Lapid. And I think what people fail to recognize is something that Lapid said early on, which I thought was very interesting, is that Israel is like one of the Baltic states, right? Israel is a country that has a border with Russia. And therefore, what the United States can say, what Australia could say, right? Or what even France or Germany could say is not the same thing that Israel could say, because Israel has to, yes, work with the Russians in Syria or be concerned about the Russians in Syria. So it has to walk a fine balance. And I think it's been doing a good job at that. Criticism is obviously open and welcome, but people should know the truth. And this constant attempt to delegitimize Israel. And you were saying to me before, right, people who are telling you, you know, why is Israel not standing with the United States and standing completely behind Ukraine? I mean, since when is that the litmus test for whether you stand with the United States or you don't? But that's what people are turning this into.
Yeah. I mean, that to me is very strange. You know, and I will start with the caveat, like, I think that Ukraine is very obviously the victim in this situation and Russia is wrong. Right. But it's not like Ukraine stands with Israel in all of its conflicts. More recently, Ukraine has moved to abstaining at the UN instead of voting against Israel at the UN. But like for most of even Zelensky's tenure as president, like Ukraine has voted against Israel. So I'm not saying that that should be the standard at the moment, but like, let's like not pretend that like this is some sort of country that like has always super supported Israel. Like, that's not the reason to support them.
Right. But I think what you do find, you know, I was watching CNN the other day in an interview that Fareed Zakariyyeh was doing with someone in Ukraine. I mean, it's not even, you can't even call it an interview. It's like one question and then let the guy talk for 10 minutes. Another question, let the guy talk for 10 minutes. I'm not exaggerating. It was not an interview. This is not critical journalism. This is not really journalism at all. And I don't want to pick on Fareed Zakariyyeh, who I have respect for and appreciation for, but I do think that when the whole world gets into a type of mode of operations and this idea as if you can't even be slightly critical, you can't say a critical word. If you ask me right now, what's my criticism of Ukraine? I'm not even sure I have it right now, what to tell you, except for maybe this constant use of the Holocaust and Nazism and these types of terms. And Zelensky's, we spoke about this in the past, of how he's compared what's happening to the Warsaw Ghetto. You know, those types of comparisons I would stay away from. But the way that the world kind of approaches this thing is very single-minded with tunnel vision. And that also contributes to the way that they're perceiving Israel. Right. And this criticism of Israel, which is doesn't really have legs to stand on.
Yeah. Yeah. There's kind of an obsession. And I mean, I'm part of it, too. Right. Like all day. This is what I'm working on. But there's definitely sort of this like obsession right now to the exclusion of other things that are going on in the world. And speaking of other things going on in the world, the Iran talks are now paused. Because of Russia, because Russia wants, right, this exception carved out of sanctions so that they can trade with Iran, even though there's sanctions on them. And I mean, I don't even know what the word is. Well, the irony or what's bizarre about the whole thing is that like Israel is sort of being saved, quote unquote, maybe by Russia, as opposed to the US, which was continuing to sit at the table with Russia, and not only sit at the table, but to sit at a negotiation that's de facto led by Russia for, you know, a couple of weeks, even after this war started and they were sanctioning Russia. It's what a mess that is.
What I find to be really interesting right now is that in Israel, you don't hear anything about it right now. I think to an extent, right, we were joking before, some people in the office, of how Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine did one thing, and that's, you know, terrible for Ukraine, but the one thing that it did do was it stopped us having to report every day about corona, right? Because I think the world has stopped reporting about corona pretty much. But the fact is that in Israel also, everyone is silent on Iran, and they're about to sign a terrible deal potentially with Iran that will let them have nuclear weapons.
You know who's not silent about Iran is Netanyahu, but of course, being as he's opposition leader, he's not getting as much attention. But Likud is actually really trying to sort of sound the alarm and say, like, hey, like, okay, great, you can do what you want with Russia and Ukraine, you know, but the real national security issue for Israel is Iran. And they're not wrong about that.
I don't think they're wrong. And I wonder, though, if it's not coming from a place of let's attack the government with this, because we know that government's not talking. Right. And it's very political. But, you know, I think that what people need to realize is that there's not only two options here, right? People tend to think either you fight with the Americans and you do what Netanyahu did in 2015 when he went to Congress and spoke out against Barack Obama and the JCPOA, or you do what Bennett's doing, which is doing nothing or not talking, at least. I don't know what he's doing behind the scenes, but publicly he's not doing anything. There's a wide space in between, right? I mean, you know, Naftali Bennett, Yair Lapid could go on CNN, Fox News, could do rounds of interviews, could go speak at think tanks, could give interviews to the Jerusalem Post. I mean, they could do a million and different things to get a point across the point that this deal is bad for Israel and it's going to be bad for the world. But really, they're not doing much at all. And why do you think that is, Lahav?
You know, it is a good question. I think there's a little bit of a feeling of, I don't know, despair is the word, but
resignation,
like that, in the sense that, okay, Netanyahu's method didn't work. So this government's trying a different method of trying to work more cooperatively with the Biden administration. And now they're in this like wait and see position of like whether there will be an Iran deal or there won't be because of Russia. And also because of this whole thing that Iran wants sanctions lifted on the IRGC and that might not be politically possible in the US. So they're continuing with this sort of cooperation tactic, even though it hasn't really changed anything for Israel. And they're hoping to like mitigate it by getting sort of assurances from the US for defense, you know, and for aid in different scenarios and things like that. But it doesn't look great.
It doesn't look great. And I think we're in trouble. Right? I think ultimately this is a really bad situation that's not going to play out well for Israel. And the resignation that we're sensing from this government could mean, could lead to the Iranians actually getting their hands on a nuclear weapon one day. I hope and pray that that doesn't happen. But I think that the lack of noise that we're hearing, the silence is deafening, let's say, in Jerusalem right now. And that's something that we should be concerned about. And it could be, by the way, and I don't know, this is not from knowledge, but I wonder if this constant involvement in the Zelensky-Putin mediation by Bennett is not also some, you know, a way to kind of just distract attention away from that. Like understanding he's resigned to the fact that I cannot change what's happening in Vienna. Here I can maybe do something, and if I focus on this, people won't be bothering me with that. I don't know if that's the case, but I wouldn't put it past what, you know, our political leaders might be doing.
Yeah, and it's pretty sad if that's the case. I mean,
but it ties in beautifully with Purim, Lahav, right? Purim is the story, ancient Persia, right? Pras, right. With a king and a bad man, Haman, who tried to commit genocide and kill the Jewish people. We survived back then. We persevered. So if that's any indication of what once happened, maybe that's what they're banking on, is another Megillah to be written in the annals of Jewish history. Yes. on that note, we have a really great lineup on this episode. We're going to be speaking with Uri Zaki, who is a member of Meretz, right? And the founder of the
Front for the Protection of Democracy.
Okay, so that pretty much is self-explanatory, liberal, progressive Democrat here in Israel. Also happens to be married to, or is the partner of, a member of Meretz. So very much involved in Meretz.
Environmental Protection Minister.
Correct.
Tamar Zandberg, and who also was on this podcast a few months ago.
So they're all protecting. Tamar Zandberg's protecting the environment. Uri Zaki is protecting democracy. So we're speaking with Uri, and we're also speaking with Yishai Fleischer, who is the spokesperson for the Jewish community in Hebron, in Judea and Samaria in the West Bank. And we're bringing these two on because we wanted to bring two opposing views and have a debate about the refugee issue in Israel, which has been stirring a lot of controversy, right? Israel initially was a little more conservative in the number of refugees it was going to allow in. It came under a lot of public pressure and public outcry, and Interior Minister Ayelet Shaked decided to open up those conditions and to allow more people into the country. But that's what we're bringing Uri and Yishai on, is to discuss that issue, bring you two opposing views. You'll guess now who is going to stand for what, but here we go.
We are ready to start our debate about the situation of Ukrainian refugees in Israel. And I think we're going to start with Yishai Fleischer, who's the spokesperson for the Jewish community in Hebron. You've talked a lot about how you think Israel should be neutral in this war. And specifically, I saw you sharing a tweet that you think that Israel does not need to be accepting Ukrainian refugees without limits, comparing it to other countries in the world. So could you explain your position on Ukrainian refugees in Israel?
Well, thanks for being there, Lahav, Yaakov. Thanks for letting me join, and Uri as well. For me, it's kind of simple that Israel is meant to be a state, a protectorate for the Jewish people. It's a Jewish state. And we are a tiny minority in this world that needs protection from persecution. And now there's a conflict. It's a Slavic conflict, and there are other Slavic countries all around there, including, for example, Poland. When I visited Poland a few years ago, I saw that there were a lot of Ukrainians living in Poland. And I think there's a lot of Ukrainians looking for asylum in Poland right now. And other countries around the world, bigger countries, countries that have a lot of space, that don't have demographic issues like we do here. And so I think to myself, when I see the humanitarian crisis, and there definitely is one, I think to myself, okay, you know, I got to bring in Jews who want to come from Ukraine, however much the amount is, let them live in the Jewish state. Great. But when it comes to non-Jewish Ukrainians, they are Slavic folks. This is a Slavic conflict. They can go to everywhere from, there's many Ukrainians, by the way, that are going to Russia. And others are going to Poland and Moldova and et cetera, et cetera. Moldova, in fact, the EU itself is allowing people in without questions for 3 years. So I really don't think there's any reason to throw in this big Jewish guilt that we're hearing now. This is a Jewish state, and we've faced the same kind of persecution. To me, this is all silly. There are many wars in this world. And the only reason that this war has gotten anybody's attention is because the media decided it did and has its own, you know, its own dynamics. But those dynamics do not have an impact on the Jewish state. Moreover, you know, I don't think that we should have any guilt vis-a-vis Ukraine. Ukraine has a long and sordid history with the Jewish people. And I don't have any emotional need to bring them in. And when I get faced with all kinds of kind of Jewish guilt lingo, I think to myself, there's something here going on that is not in the interest of some kind of like goodness, but rather in the interest of destabilizing the Jewish state and as a Jewish country. And Common Lipskin, a journalist from Ma'ariv, just came out with an article really blasting the effort to bring in non-Jewish Ukrainians into Israel. And he showed that over the last few years, there's been a regular yearly attempt of Ukrainian nationals to find refuge here in Israel, even way before the war. Many of these people do not fit even under the law of return. And they are looking to come here because of economic reasons. They're not really running from a war-torn country. They're coming here because Israel has economic advantages. And many of them do not fulfill the requirements of the law of return. They simply don't belong here. So we should send humanitarian aid. Surely we should be, you know, friendly to people who need help. And if people came here through transit, give them blankets and food, but send them on their way and don't undermine the issues of the Jewish state and its majority and its people that need to be protected first.
Okay. So Yishai, thank you for that. Uri, I want to go to you, you know, in addition to all your work, you're also the chairman of the Meretz Executive, so very much involved also in politics. And you tweeted the other day, basically, and I'm translating from Hebrew, but when in Ukraine there are again mass graves after 80 years, the Jewish state cannot stand and do nothing, basically. And you see, you continue and go on that the demographic concerns that Yishai just, I think explained well from that side of the political map, are exaggerated. They're not true. Israel needs to do more. It needs to open its gates to refugees of this war. So please explain to us your position on this.
Very good. And thank you again for having me. And thanks for this debate. You know, Yishai mentioned Jewish guilt. I honestly don't think it's about Jewish guilt. It's about Jewish morals. What does it mean to be a Jewish state? To me, you know, we are in an unprecedented event. Nothing similar happened since World War II, when one country and one person, one dictator, aggressively attacking the sovereignty of another country with a declared aim of, you know, making this country vanish. And stop being a sovereign country, making it part of his own empire. This is something that us as Jews, we see and we must act. We can't ignore what's happening. It's not, I don't know, I really resent the Slavic conflicts or something like that. This is these are human beings. This is the way nations treat each other. This is the world order, which is being undermined as we speak. And I believe that our Jewish values, even before the universal human values here, obligate us to definitely, first, we can't be neutral. We have to say who's the aggressor and who's being attacked. And second, we have to be involved in many ways. I don't think that militarily involved, that should not be the way, but definitely be part of the world sanctions and to point the finger. I think we have a moral obligation to do that. And also being the inheritance of Jewish history and Jewish recent history, where our fathers, grandfathers, grandmothers were refugees and were not accepted anywhere in the world. And many of them had to return. We know, you know, St. Louis and all those famous stories had to return to their death in Europe. We cannot afford being closing our gates. I honestly don't think, with all due respect, that people who would come here supervised will know when they come. We know when the conflict ends, you know, our demographic threat to Israel. By the way, you mentioned my tweet, and it's good that Ishai is here. And mind you, as you said before, Ishai is the spokesperson for the Hebron Jewish settlement. It's amazing that the same people who are undermining the Jewish majority in Israel by preaching to annex the Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, with its almost 3 million Palestinians, are now shouting and screaming, oh, there's a demographic threat on Israel. It's crazy. But again, putting the political debate aside, the internal political debate aside, we must also open our gates again with supervision. Well, you know, refugees have to be defined as refugees, meaning that once the situation that caused the refugee issue ends, they will go back. I don't think there's any undermining of our demography here. And I think it's our Jewish obligation to do that. Not guilt, obligation, value. You know, we are truly see ourselves as a light to nations, and we should act this way too.
Yishai, though, I just want to quickly go back to you for a moment. Based on what Uri said, you know, I think it is an interesting question. I've thought of this myself. Is that you are hearing, and you know, things do tend to divide along political lines on any issue, right? So it could be the Palestinians, or it could be immigration. You see that also play out in America, right? The Republicans want to be tougher on immigration. The Democrats want to be more liberal on immigration. Okay, fine. But it is an interesting question of the position on the Palestinians versus the question of the refugees when it comes to demographics. What do you say to that?
Well, it's not, Yaakov, it's not like we're ecstatic to bring in hundreds of thousands or millions of Palestinians into the state of Israel. We have a different issue here, which is the land of Israel, which we don't want to give up. And we don't believe that cutting it will do anything useful for us, because we believe that we'll be attacked just like we were attacked from Gaza. And so we are aware of the quandary. There's a quandary, which is the land of Israel versus the people who are now living on the land of Israel. And yes, you know, I've written a New York Times article about alternative solutions to the two-state solutions, how to give certain rights but not other rights. And I don't disagree that it's a problem, but I don't think it's going to be fixed by bringing in tens of thousands more Ukrainians. Meaning to say, Uri's saying, Yisha, you want to bring in all these Palestinians? I'm like, well, yeah, there's a problem here, but you want to bring in even more Ukrainians. I think that I fully and absolutely admit that we have a problem of anti-Zionist post, you know, a Palestinian minority, almost not a minority, living on the land of Israel. What do we do with them? And I've grappled with that question. But the answer is not to bring in 20,000 more Ukrainians. And with regarding to the demographics, you know what, before I even go to demographics, I think that what I said in the beginning is exactly what Uri went to. It's all about Jewish guilt. We have to, because of our history. What are we talking about here? Ukrainians are being welcomed in the EU. Ukrainians, he doesn't like that it's a Slavic conflict, but it is a Slavic conflict. And there are right now some 27 active conflicts around the world, ones with a lot more deaths around the world, but we just don't care about them because they're not on our newsfeed. So let's just be real and recognize the fact that we live in, you know, real states with real borders. We cannot endanger our border right now. Moreover, I think there's something that's bothering me in this whole Ukraine-Russia thing in Israel's perspective on it. And that is that, you know, just yesterday, there was 38 attacks on Jews in Judea and Samaria, on the roads, with Molotov cocktails against our soldiers. In fact, three terrorists were killed in a conflict yesterday with our soldiers. We are still very much facing a security situation. And when I look at the way Israel thinks about Ukraine, I'm thinking to myself, guys, we're not there yet to supply everybody else's solutions. We have our own problems, our own security problems that we have to deal with, not to mention, and who knows better than you, Yaakov, the Iran issue that is on the table right now. So I just don't think that we should be too generous, too gregarious, too giving, when in fact these people have a solution, and the solution coming here is not the solution. Moreover, the figures that Kamen Lipscan dug up show that there's been about 15,000 people in the last 5 years that have tried to come from Ukraine on tourist visas, but then immediately apply for refugee status. And then about 10,000 of them have also, after applying, have also applied for reunification of families to bring their wives or husbands over. And so it is certainly a demographic threat, one that's going to blow up later. I've also dealt with some non-Jewish Ukrainians, and I've here in Israel, and I've even faced their anti-Semitism that I saw. And so we have to care about our own problems first. And of course, if we can supply humanitarian aid out there and we fly out there, you know, it's a beautiful thing, good for Israel for being, you know, first responders in humanitarian places. But that doesn't mean they should come to the Jewish thing.
So, Uri, you know, beyond the demographic issue, there is this sort of concept that we are prepared to accept 100,000 people from Ukraine and Russia, but probably mostly Ukraine, who qualify under the law of return. Some Jewish, some not, but they qualify under the law of return. And do you think that Israel should not have a limit on how many other people can come in? I mean, 100,000 is already a lot of people. So, like, how do you envision that policy-wise? Because right now it's anyone who has somewhere to stay temporarily. Basically, anyone who has family, close friends can come in. So, you know, but for people who don't have family or friends here, it is much more limited. So what do you think Israel should be doing?
Listen, Lahav, I think, you know, first of all, by the way, I believe that more Olim, more Jewish immigrants or Jewish-related immigrants will come actually from Russia, not from the Ukraine, just because the Ukrainians right now have so many alternatives, in Europe and in neighboring countries, and in Western Europe. So I'm not sure that there'll be a flood of Ukrainian Jews or Jewish-related Olim coming here. But I do think that the Russians who feel that the Iron Curtain is looming again in their country might come here, especially with the economical sanctions. In any case, we have to differentiate between those who are allowed in through the law of return and refugees. When we talk about Jews who or Jewish relatives who come under the law of return, we're talking about naturalizing them in Israel automatically. They not only do they get the Israeli citizenship right away, they also get a lot of financial support. As any, you know, that's the foundation of our country, being the safe haven to any Jew in the world, and the way the state legalized or made it into law was anyone who's a relative to a Jew, even in a second degree relation. When it comes to refugees, it's a different story. It's not like they're becoming citizens of Israel. They won't have the right to vote or anything like that. They'll have limited visas on how long they can stay, as I said before, related also to the status in the Ukraine, whether it's still under attack or not. So we're not talking about a real demographic threat or anything like that. We're talking about really opening our gates to refugees in a country that was founded on the catastrophe of the Jewish fate in Europe. And you know, it's not about who did what. You know, on the one hand, my own family, okay, my grandmother had to dig her own grave, and thank God, Toda Lael, she was saved, but she had a bullet in her head, and two of her her two siblings, her sister and brother, all three were attacked by Ukrainians in the Shoah. That doesn't mean anything. I mean, right now we are a country and we need to open our gates. By the way, Germany, the aggressor back then, is now opening its gates. It's given up on its main source of energy from Russia, meaning that it's going through a very difficult financial time, even perhaps problems with heating folks' houses, because they know they have to be on the right side of history. And we have to be on the right side of history. We have a moral obligation. We have an historical obligation. It's not guilt. This is part of, I see Israel not as any other country. I see it, as I said before, this state was not founded as just a Jewish ghetto. It was founded on moral principles that derive from starting with our prophets in the biblical times, but also with modern history. And we must fulfill it. We can't, shut our eyes to a catastrophe which is happening right now. And that's why I think we have to open our gates. Again, I'm not talking about naturalizing these people. I'm talking about opening our gates to refugees. And again, if I'll be realistic, most of them will choose other alternatives. They will not come here. So even practically speaking, it's not a real threat.
So I do want to take advantage of the fact that we have the two of you who are, in addition to these very strong and interesting positions on the issue of the Ukrainian refugees, but you also have very clear positions when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And Lav and I spoke earlier about how people are now conflating between the two and are trying to apply what's happening with Russia and Ukraine to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. One thing that I'm concerned about, Yishai, is that come a future war, God forbid, between Israel and Hamas in Gaza, let's say, and you're already starting to hear these voices, and then Uri, I do want to also hear your take on this, is you're already starting to hear people who are saying, those sanctions against Russia, we should be applying them against Israel. You hear Labour Party MPs in Britain who are talking about this. I saw an article about the world's number one squash player. Turns out he's Egyptian, by the way. Just a nice little fact to know. Calling also to apply these same measures against Israel. And it might not happen now, but I think that if there is another conflict, we could see some of that happening. Yishai, does this at all concern you?
Absolutely. Absolutely, Yaakov. Right from the get-go, when I started seeing these sweeping sanctions, which I think are really... I don't understand the legal pretext for them even. What's the rationale for banning oligarchs, freezing their monies and freezing their yachts and all stuff like that? Did these people start this war because they were friends with Putin? I was very disappointed, by the way, at Israel, at our country, our beloved country, that didn't give some kind of safety for people like Roman Abramovich. What did he do exactly other than support universities, the Tel Aviv University, and other than doing good things for Israel? What, did he start this war because Putin did something? Then all his friends are now marred with the same ignominious act of starting conflict with Ukraine. He had nothing to do with it. And I really think that there's an absurd kind of witch hunt, a kind of extension of a cancel culture. And I think that Israel should be a haven, not just for Jewish refugees, but for also Jewish wealthy people. And there's nothing wrong with that. And I think that's actually part of our moral obligation also. And people are running from Russia, not just from Ukraine. Jews are running from Russia, including wealthy people. And I think we should be the first place that they feel safe in. And it's like, okay, here you go. You got that passport 5 years ago. Now you could use it. And I you know what I mean? To me, it's a big disappointment when I saw that reportedly Abramovich left Israel for Turkey. I was like, that's a missed opportunity. This guy could be a very strong and good player here in Israel. With regarding to what you asked specifically, the minute this started happening, I said to myself, this is just a dry run to go against Israel. Next time we have a conflict with Gaza, the whole world is going to shut down, the SWIFT economics, the SWIFT bank transfer system, et cetera, et cetera. And I fear it. I don't like it. I think that if you want to have a conflict. I don't think that we should be doing BDS the way we don't want BDS to be done unto us. And I am 100% concerned with the system of sanctions. And suddenly the world decides Russians, not Russia, not Putin, Russians are bad. In Poland they've now banned Russian music like Tchaikovsky, like Peter and the Wolf. I think it's a kind of madness. And I'm certainly concerned about that. Israel's got to bulletproof itself from that. Israel's got to have relationships that are going to make sure that we are not going to be locked out from food supplies, from trade, from financial services. And we got to find countries that are not going to be part of it. You know, for example, like India or other countries,
right.
We should be definitely friendly with them in case this kind of madness attacks us in the next conflict.
So, Uri, what's your take on that?
First of all, I think the best way to make sure that we will never be sanctioned or anything like that is to return to political negotiations with the Palestinians. Not only it's a shield from any sanctions in the future, which honestly I don't see coming, but it's mainly the only way to maintain Israel as a Jewish national state and a democracy. I think the only Zionist way to maintain Israel, to have a secure future, is through a political solution, a negotiated political solution with the Palestinians. Trust me, you will not see any boycotts, nor sanctions, anything like that. Having said all that, I honestly don't think that the sanctions against Russia, the rightly affected sanctions against Russia, are a threat to Israel, especially if we'll be part of the right side of history, and if we'll remember what is our family, and if we remember where we are strategically, and that's part of the democratic West, that's part of the American-led coalition. With all due respect to all, to India, to Russia, to China, at the end of the day, we are still following, since Ben-Gurion took a strategic, smart decision, and by the way, back then it wasn't obvious at all, to align with the United States. Our strategic alliance with the United States, it's what is what helps helping us, of course, together with our own military power and our moral grounds and you name it, but also our strategic alliance with the United States is the main reason we are, you know, we can defend ourselves, and we should continue doing so. And right now, when the United States is leading a world coalition or a Western coalition, a democratic coalition against an aggressor that is like no other since the 1930s and 40s, we have to be part of that coalition. We have to take a stand. As I said before, it's our moral obligation, but it's also realpolitik. If we want to continue being part of this family, when this family is going to is acting, we should be part of it.
All right. Well, on that note, we are going.
If I could just add one.
Yeah.
I think that it's important to realize that Russia is part of our. Russia is our neighbor here in Syria, and it's part of our security strategic situation, and we have to keep in mind that making an enemy out of Russia is a dangerous business that we really don't want to get into, especially since there's the issues of Iran and Hezbollah and the trafficking of.
Isha, you're attacking in Syria with American weapon
and with Russian clearance.
American budget.
I didn't say make an enemy of America.
If you're not choosing the right side of history, when America is now leading something, then you are choosing.
You're very sure about what the right side of history is. And Uri, if you let me, I appreciate it. What I'm saying to you is, I hear what you're saying, and it's nice to have such moral clarity. But I think that the picture is complex. I think this is a very old conflict. Certainly, Putin's actions against Ukraine are inexcusable. But still, at the same time, there are many old issues here. There are many economic factors here, and I don't think that we should be getting into other people's conflicts every time we think we understand the moral issues. I think the most moral thing is to make sure that we are a safe and protected state. Russia is part of our strategic alliance in this region. So is the United States. I urge a more neutral position on it. I think we should be helpful.
I'll just add to that. Sorry, Lahav is Yishai, is that it's unclear if you can anymore. And I think that this debate illustrates the complexity of it. Can even a country stay neutral as much as it wants to or as it tries to. But I'll let Lahav wrap up.
I mean, I think we have two different positions here, and it's been very interesting to hear both sides. I think there's definitely positions in the middle as well, maybe, that, you know, a certain amount of refugees, or I think the government's trying to take the middle ground, right, when it comes to where to be on this war, that they support Ukraine, but also aren't going all in the way everyone in the West is. So I want to thank you both for an enlightening conversation and a civilized one, which is, you know, it's not something we should take for granted.
Not always so, easy in Israel. So thank you.
Yes.
Both. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode. You can catch us always on all platforms that play podcasts. Please share widely with your friends and family. We'll see you next week.